No matter who you are, where you are in your spiritual journey, you are celebrated here. So let's begin with silence. Take a deep breath, shut your eyes if that's helpful. And may grace be in our heads and in our thinking. Grace be in our eyes and in our seeing. May grace be in our ears and in our hearing. May grace be in my mouth and in my speaking. And may grace be in our hearts and in our understanding. And may grace be at our ends and at our departing. That was all there, and I didn't have that slide up. Sorry about that. Okay, as I was saying, we lost that. We've been talking about this, living in the sacred stream. It feels like a long time since I've gotten to teach here. Several weeks, yeah? So I have missed it. And I don't say this enough. I want you to know what an absolute privilege it is for me to get to do this. And I don't take you or this opportunity for granted. I'm very, very grateful. So just as a very quick reminder, the matters that we're trying to understand are four things, and they're woven together like a braid. One is to grow in our understanding of and commitment to sacred mystery. One is to grow in our understanding of and participation in a greater understanding of ourselves. One is to grow in our understanding of and a greater participation in the evolutionary process of which we are a part, whether we acknowledge that or not. And further, to grow in our willingness to understand, sometimes with serious engagement of biblical materials, the message of Jesus, with a commitment to get that message alive in us and also alive in the world. Big agenda. Now, it might be possible for someone in another culture to focus on the first three of these, the sacred, the self, and the cosmos, without referring to Jesus. But in this culture, particularly at this time, it is both an academic and a philosophical impossibility, as I see it, not to focus on Jesus, particularly in this time of growing Christian nationalism. So we will also be paying serious attention to that. Not today and not next Sunday, but we will get there. Right now, it's my intention to focus on these first two things, the issue of sacred mystery and self and their relationship to each other. And I'm doing this because of the feedback that I got after a class that I offered in here, not the very last time I taught, but the time before that. In the teaching that I gave here on April the 14th, I said, and by the way, all of this is out on the internet by Tuesday, so that you can see the slides and see the text of the talk, if that's helpful for you to do. What I said in that talk was that many people, and I was talking about Jesus, many people, not all to be sure, saw in Jesus the power and presence and purpose of God. His very existence seemed marked by freedom and love. People who had been marginalized by society, those who were called unclean and shameful, found in him the joy of acceptance and forgiveness. Those who were warped and twisted in all sorts of ways found in him a source of peace. He was a person who experienced and expressed what theologian Rudolf Bultmann called authentic existence, And he possessed what theologian Paul Tillich called the courage to be. You and I could have no finer goal for our spiritual, religious, and psychological growth than these two goals: authentic existence and the courage to be. And I was asked by numerous people to elaborate on what those two terms, authentic existence and courage to be, meant. And that's what this class today is about. And I thought and thought and thought and thought about it. And there are at least a dozen doors to open and go through to get to this topic. But I'm going to start with how it came to be for me when I first encountered these key phrases of being and belonging, and they resonated so with me. They were when I found them, like Jesus' parable about the treasure hidden in the field of pearl of great price, or pearls of great price. So that's what I'm going to try to do today. And we will begin here. How do we learn how to be? Or perhaps more honestly, how and where do we learn how to be in order to survive in the world? One of my professors of psychology said that as soon as the umbilical cord is cut, the questions that nature gives to the newborn child are, who is in charge here, and how do I get along with that person? And it's in the process of our discovering the answers to these questions that we begin to shape our understanding of ourselves and of the environment and people around us. That's the initial classroom in which we learn who we are and how to be. Of course, it is much, much more complicated than that. But that's the beginning. I don't think in all the time I've been teaching here, I've ever mentioned the name of Don Winnicott, but he is likely one of the most influential voices in the field of psychology. He did his pioneering work in the field of child development in England during and right after World War II, when so many children were separated from their parents and sent to other places to be safe from bombing. He developed and studied theories on attachment theory. As far as we know, he's the first person to use the phrase the true self, the false self, in talking about human personality. And in developing the psychological schema that he came to develop, he is the person who developed the concept, paradoxical concept, of being alone together. A whole of two words, alone together. That's what he used to describe the first few moments and days and weeks of a newborn's life. The newborn is thrust into the world alone, and yet must survive dependent on the caretaker, primary caretaker's, ideally the mother's, ability. And so in the very beginning, those of you who've had children know this, the infant's frontal lobe has not developed to the ability to be able to distinguish a difference between itself and the mother. In this, I'm using mother here. But there comes a moment when the mother, looking into the infant's eyes, the infant looks back at the mother. Now, up until then, the mother is just gazing into unknowing eyes. But those of you who are mothers know that there is this time when the infant recognizes you. Winnicott says that if that moment never happens, the infant could not emerge as an adult. He could not differentiate her or himself. And Winnicott goes on to say, and I've always wondered how these child analysts know all this stuff, but he went on to say that if the infant thought that it was going to lose contact with this mother, it would never emerge. It would never develop that separation ability. So it has to know that it can be safely connected and separate at the same time, alone, together. That make sense? Okay. So it's out of this dynamic that psychologists talk about things like separation anxiety, attachment theory. And he also came up with the phrase, just good enough mother. That is somebody who's not too smothering and not prone to experience, give the infant the experience of unavailability. By the way, one of the reasons that Goldilocks and the Three Bears is so popular with young children is because it speaks to this very dynamic of being just enough about the porridge, the chair, the bed. One was too hot, one was too cold, one was just right. One was too hard, one was too soft, one was just right. So baby bear right is very important. Now those of you who have children know that they come into the world and they are useless. I'm serious. And many people would say that they remain so through their teens. They don't pay rent. They can't dress themselves. They can't feed themselves. They can't do chores. They can't chip in. And yet, this infant, just days old, can reach out and grab your finger as if it were a scepter and become king or queen. Now, in an ideal world, the mother and father would be mentally healthy, sober, sane, stable, grounded, awake, and compassionate. In an ideal world, the infant would absorb a message about its preciousness. In an ideal world, the growing infant would be surrounded by people who would mirror back the child's worth, the child's development. It would be a safe container for that child. But we don't live in an ideal world. I don't know what your experience was growing up. I grew up clearly in a privileged middle-class family with parents who had the highest moral standards, and they gave me every opportunity imaginable to internalize messages of shame and guilt. Lack of self-worth. I cannot imagine what our world is going to be like, what the world is like for those infants growing up in Ukraine and Gaza. One of the major things that I experienced when I began my clinical training, which I'm going to reference again in a minute, was that there was no aspect of my clinical training that equipped me to deal with the amount and degree of abuse and violence that exists in the American family. Now, that it's in the American family is statistically understandable because that's where we spend most of our time, but that there is so much of it. And it cuts across all economic and educational boundaries. So we survive this childhood in a multitude of ways. We internalize the messages that we get from our environment, either real or imagined, and then we use those in adulthood to talk about ourselves. How are you doing? Well, I'm worried about myself. Or I can't do anything right. Or if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Or I don't know why people don't realize how special I am. I am doing the best I can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when you step back and look at these conversations we have with ourselves, we actually sound rather schizophrenic. Who is talking to who? And yet each of us has developed this ability to talk about ourselves. Now, because many of the messages that children get are so painful, we put them away and we use a variety of ways to survive them. Best one in this culture is alcohol. Pornography, sex addiction, drugs, working all the time, gambling. The best way to deal with the pain of childhood is to act, become an actor. We perform a role that we think or experience gets us the attention that we want or deflects it. And we learn to act in ways that get us what we think at the time that we want, attention, approval, appreciation, or their opposite, a punishment. I don't know if many of you are old enough to remember or know who Jules Feiffer is. Jules Feiffer used to draw cartoons for The New Yorker. And he is one of my heroes because he's not only still working, but he's 95. And he had a cartoon that, series of cartoons that depicts perfectly the situation of those who experience the failure to be. And that is to say, they have an inner core, but they haven't accessed that inner core. So they depend for others on their self-definition. And in the cartoon sequence, which I couldn't find or I would have put it up there, there is this boy, Danny, who is having this self-conversation. Ever since I was a little kid, I didn't want to be me. I wanted to be Billy Whittleton. And Billy didn't even like me. But I walked like he walked, I talked like he talked, I signed up for the same high school he did, which was when Billy Whittleton changed. He began to hang around Herbie Vanderman and walk and talk like Herbie Vanderman. And then it dawned on me that Herbie Vanderman walked and talked like Joy Haverland. And Joy Haverland walked and talked like Corky Sabinson. And who do you think that Corby Sabinson is always walking and talking like? Of all people, Dopey Kenny Wellington. That little pest who walks and talks like me. Now, not everybody takes this route. There are a lot of other ways to get separated from our true selves, to cover up the self. So there is this way that I've just described of understanding how we come to be, okay? We get separated from our true selves and we create a false self. And then there comes this ontological shock that is right up there with the Copernican shock. When this guy named Sigmund Freud said, oops, it's not all it is appears to be. There is this thing called the unconscious. When I first began teaching ordinary life, I showed this graphic so much that it's up on there with a par with my ranting about having a daily spiritual practice and not using your turn signal. This is an iceberg. And it depicts the human personality. And the reason I wanted to use it is to say that about 90% of all of us, that you, me, is underneath the surface of the water. About 10% above is above, and the very tippy top of the iceberg is what we call the ego. A great definition of the unconscious is that we do not know what we do not know. It's not a secret you're keeping from yourself. It's not something that you know, but you don't want others to know. We don't know. And yet, what we don't know often makes tremendous decisions for us. A joke about it, of course, is known as the Freudian slip, when we say one thing and meet our mother. So Freud wanted to establish the discipline of psychiatry as a purely scientific endeavor, but he had a somewhat younger colleague who differed with him. His name was Sigmund Freud, and it was Carl Jung. And Carl Jung took exception with Jung, and they parted ways. And this is just a graphic of Jung's understanding of the unconscious. We have so much that is down there, including the collective unconscious. I'm not going to talk about this. You don't need to remember it. But if you want to go back on Tuesday and get this, you can look and see what lives inside of you that you might not be aware of. I myself am tremendously benefited by the works of Jung. Indeed, doing Jungian dream work, as you've heard me say, saved my life, led me to delve into Jungian analysis myself for a path to follow, okay? So let's do a situation check. You know when the pilot comes on the airplane and says, return to your seats, fasten your seatbelt, we're about to hit some turbulent weather? Here we go. I hope that you are mindful and of the paradoxical and contradictory, at least puzzling manner, when we hear people say things like, well, I need to find myself. And occasionally you will hear that in a novel or a movie or from somebody. They throw away everything, their job, their marriage, and everything, and they go off to find themselves. Which I think is kind of like looking for your own eyeball. Nonetheless, we've been talking about how we enter the world as infants, how we differentiate, how we develop a personality. And if you were to go to see a competent therapist, and you didn't know that person, they didn't know you, I'm guessing that it would take between 3 and 6 sessions for that person even to begin to think they have an inkling of an understanding about who you are. So in psychology, one of the things that we look for during those first 6 sessions are the things that we've been talking about. What kind of bonding did the person experience? Was there a mother? Was there an adoption? Was there good nurture, or was it aloof and distant? Was mom depressed or alcoholic? Or did mom have you 10 months right after you had your older sibling? That sort of thing we look for. And then we're interested in what kind of behaviors did this child experience in the first 6 to 12 years of life. Was it loving, consistent? Was there abuse? Was there straightforwardness? Was there secrecy? Whatever. Looking for that. And then we look for what I call the SEA of beliefs in which a person is immersed growing up. What were you taught to believe about others, about God, about yourself? Because we ingest these beliefs and they become part of who we are. All of these things shape us. Now, I think these things that we've been talking about so far are universal. Whether you're born in the Netherlands or South Africa or wherever these things apply. But we have these experiences, and we have given them the interpretations we have given them because we have been born here. Wherever here is for you. But what if you weren't born here? What if you were born there? Wherever there might be. What if you were brought up in a different family context? What if you were brought up reading different books? What if you read at all? What if you were brought up having different teachers belonging to a very different culture? Would you still be you? And if so, how do you know who you are? Where do you begin? And all the saturating influences of culture and education leave off. Now, these are not easily answered questions, but they are fodder that you can use for your daily spiritual practice, right? I'm trying to tell you what authentic existence is. And where I'm beginning is by saying that the first step in acknowledging self-knowledge is to concede that we don't know who we are. And I contend that that is our common situation, and if we could embrace that, it would make us more compassionate toward each other. So, to quote one of my very favorite philosophers, John Caputo, to be on a spiritual journey is to be a little spooked by the radical contingency of our situation, both individually and communally. No one person, group, or culture has the answer or the truth. And yet I'm going to claim that nevertheless, the phrases from Bultmann and Tillich, authentic existence and courage to be, are worthy goals to reach for as long as we know we cannot reach them. That's hopeful to me. I'll say more about that in a minute. Now, this next step I want to take in getting at authentic existence is very, very personal. All of my teaching is autobiographical, but this is self-consciously and deliberately so. I'm going to share with you how I discovered these phrases and how they led me to develop the platform from which I have been teaching these last 60 years. And I've yet to plumb its depths. So this excursion that I am about to take will take us, hopefully, to a clear definition of authentic existence. And again, I'm just going to tell you up front, this is very personal, okay? So don't tell anybody. Some of this stuff I knew at the time, and some of it I pieced together in analysis years later. So let's start with involvement in the civil rights movement. I think that one of the reasons that I had such empathy for the people of color with whom and around whom I grew up is that I sensed the unfairness of their being judged for something over which they had no control, the color of their skin. Because I felt that same judgment in my family. There were ways that I had developed to be that I felt critical, felt being criticized for, shamed about, guilty of, and it felt to me that I had no control over that. Now, I'm not bashing my parents. They did the best that they knew how with the awareness that they had, and they had a childhood, which it took me years to uncover and find out about. But the fact is that I grew up in a family where there were very deep wounds and very dark secrets that were never acknowledged. My brother's way of dealing with this was to become an alcoholic. He became a very rigid, conservative, angry person, high functioning, But his mindset and lifestyle led him to an early death. His grandchildren referred to him as Grumps because he was so angry. My way, because I'm a 7 on the Enneagram, was to push pain away and develop several abilities to joke and to perform. Look at what I do. And then to get the hell out of Dodge as soon as possible. In the meantime, in that family, given the tools that I was given, being told that there was an answer in the Bible or in the church or in Jesus or something, I read everything I could get my hands on to deal with the anxiety that I felt all the time. I was sure that there must be something I could learn, somebody I could talk to that would banish this anxiety and fear. If I had a family now come to see me, and the adolescent, young adolescent in that family, an 11, 12-year-old kid, was reading the books that I was reading at that time, I would think, there's something wrong with this picture. So it was as an adolescent that I had my first encounter with the phrase, courage to be. It was in one of Tillich's books. My parents were educated. My mother was a high school English teacher. We had a lot of books in libraries. I read thinking, well, where could I find that kind of courage? And the beginning of an answer took shape when a trusted teacher advised me to leave that part of the country where I live, Middle Tennessee, and go elsewhere. And using the parochial, naive knowledge that I had, I came to Texas. That's not a criticism. I grew up in a Baptist church. The Baptist church knew about Baylor University. I came to Baylor. And my students, my teachers were recommending, of all things, Paul Tillich and Carl Jung. Wow. This was an answer. It was a wonderful world for me. No one knew me. I didn't know anyone. I did not feel alone or lonely. I felt excited and hopeful. And during my first couple of weeks in Waco, I was walking by a drugstore that also sold books. Now, this is a university town. Drugstores used to do that. And a book caught my eye. I had read other books by this author because he was in our home. Books of sermons that he wrote. My father taught Sunday school. People didn't know what to give him for Christmas presents. They went to the bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee, said, I have a Sunday school teacher. What do you recommend? Here, give him this book. He brought it home, put it on the shelf, and I read it. That's how that worked. And the book that I saw in Waco was a book by Harry Emerson Fosdick called On Being a Real Person. There is no telling how many times I have read this book. I'm not recommending it. There are better things on the subject. But at the time, it spoke to a very real, deep need for me. Harry Emerson Fosdick preached at Riverside Church in New York, which was right next door to Union Seminary, which is right next door to where Paul Tillich taught. So they influenced each other. And eventually, I got to go spend some time at Union. By the way, Fosdick had an influence on this church over here, which someday I'll tell you about. That's another story. So by the end of my time at Baylor, I knew that what I wanted to do was to teach. And I had this modest goal because I could see the writing on the wall about fundamentalism coming. My modest goal was to go get a graduate degree in theology and end up teaching in seminary, teaching preachers, and that way I could reform the entire Southern Baptist Convention. My ego still needed a smidgen of work. But my wish was granted. I got to teach there. And after my second year of teaching, on the eve of being put on tenure track, I was fired. And what I was told was that I had no future teaching there because, as the dean of the School of Theology put it, your theology is too aggressive. I wish to this day I had been more inquisitive about what he meant, because I don't know. I do know I'm glad I got fired, because if I had not, if I had stayed there, I'd be dead by now, I think. It's very difficult to work for an institution without getting compromised. Okay, I'll just say that. Though you've heard me say on numerous occasions, I had the best teachers, both at Baylor and at Southwestern, possible, I think. We read what was up. We read Karl Barth, who's a very conservative guy, by the way. We read Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I'm sure you've heard of, Reinhold Niebuhr. He's the guy who wrote the Serenity Prayer. We read Paul Tillich, Rudolf Bultmann, a bunch of other people. They led us into very serious biblical studies with the hypocrisy of don't teach this. That was true. You can't teach this because you'll get fired in the church. I read Carl Jung, found that, had a religious experience doing that in seminary. Bultmann was a radical theologian, but not in the way that you might think. He was not a liberal. He was an anti-liberal person. He was a Lutheran scholar. He was a great scholar. But he thought that trying to figure out what Jesus actually said and did was a waste of time. Don't do that. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you pay attention to what his early followers preached about him. You have faith in that preaching. And if people turn down that message, don't let it be because they get caught up not believing in a literal heaven or hell or virgin birth or resurrection. All that stuff doesn't matter. What matters is that people respond to God in the same way that Jesus did, by living authentically. So the phrase authentic existence came from the writings of Rudolf Bultmann. He was an existentialist of the highest order, and he was great. So after getting fired, I had no place to go. There was a church here in Houston that was the product of a group of highly educated liberal folks who were looking for somebody to be, as they put it at the time, this is during the 60s, during the time of what was called the Great Church Renewal Movement. We are looking for somebody who would be like a resident theologian for us. I said, I'm your guy. That sounds great to me. We would like for you to come and teach, and we will relieve you from the responsibility of making a living. That was their way of saying, we'll pay you. And then in exchange, you can help us become a church. So one of the members of this group was head at the time of an organization in the medical center called the Institute of Religion. Now, I had to go on the internet to get a picture of this building. It no longer exists in a medical center, but it even was in the medical center with this title on the top of it. It was the Institute of Religion. And they offered academic and clinical training for psychologists and ministers who were interested in that path of study. And my deal with this church was that if you will pave the way for me to get involved in that program and be there, both academically and clinically, as part of my compensation, that would be great. They did, and I was there for 7 years, in addition to doing my other stuff. Now, the reason this is important is because, the reason I wanted that is because when I was teaching in seminary and students from seminary would come to Houston, some would go other places, but mostly to Houston, for a summer quarter of what we call CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. When they came back to seminary, They were different people. They were more authentic. Now, you won't be surprised to hear that most people who go to seminary imitate other preachers. They want to be like Billy Graham, or they wanted to be like Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, who was a popular figure on TV at that time. They didn't want to be themselves. But guys who came, there were no women in my class, by the way, guys who came to CPE and then came back to seminary, they were different. They were just different. They seemed more authentic. If I were to be made king, I would require that every person who works in a clergy status for any church anywhere would have clinical pastoral education, without exception. You couldn't get up and preach or pray until you'd had that. Because, this is judgmental sounding, but so many preachers who don't have that, when they preach and pray, God leaves the room. You can just tell. There's nothing real about what they're doing. So they also said, we would like to know, what are you going to teach when you come? And I developed a sentence that I have been using ever since. I have not plumbed the depth of it yet. We could spend class periods on each major word of this. But we are to be involved in the process of becoming centers of freedom and love. The focus is on we. We don't have a we in our culture right now very much. Sherry and I live right over there, and so we walk, as we did yesterday, to Herman Park. The weather the last number of weeks has been so incredibly beautiful. To walk down to Herman Park by the reflecting pool, through the Japanese garden, and it's just wonderful. It really is wonderful time to be. And coming back one day not long ago, I asked my beautiful bride to stop because I was going to pretend to take her picture. I didn't want to take her picture. I wanted to take this picture. This is heartbreaking. Beautiful day with people you supposedly like and love, and on your blankety blank phone. That's where we live, right there. Involve means not standing back, not being observers, not saying, well, I'll see, but jumping in the stream. The process means not a static place we get to and defend, but an ongoing process with the realization that we are in this process or we are not. Now listen, whether we are physically dead or not, if we are not in process, we cease to be. We are deceased. A lot of dead people are not underground. We are centers, always working on integrating the disowned, repressed, denied, ignored aspects of ourselves that live in the unconscious. Great access to this is dream work, active imagination, other things. Freedom is the ultimate meaning of the word salvation, space to move around in. And love is the essence of it all. Love for self first. Because you will not love anybody more than you love yourself. You will not let anybody love you more than you love yourself. I'm not talking about narcissistic stuff. I'm talking about enlightened self-interest, where we live in such a way to create a world that's full of love and compassion. You commit to this path, and you are living authentic existence. and it takes guts. You'll notice there's nothing overtly religious about my formulation about being involved in being centers of freedom and love. You can do it without being religious. I think having religion is fun. But I put it that way because I wanted to create a tent and table big enough for everybody. The church has been so good on saying who's not welcome. We can change that. So theologians and psychologists have for centuries puzzled about why don't people pick up this path and walk it. In the Jewish tradition, the call is to life, over and over and over and over and over to life. They mean this authentic life. Jesus said, I have come that you might have life. Choose life, have life to the full. And both refer to this authentic existence. But humans so often refuse this path. And whether we choose to be numb, we choose to be withdrawn, we choose to be fragmented. And you see it all around you. People who are deliberately, unconsciously, but deliberately choosing bondage, darkness, death, to freedom, life, and light. I don't think there's anything that more insistently raises the question about the meaning of life than choosing life when those times are difficult, but it must be done anyway. I had a colleague tell me the other day that on the very days when he most feels, God, I'd love to go home and have a drink, are the days he makes sure he does not do that. Make sense? Now, there's some paragraphs in the English language in our tradition, the Christian tradition, that are so exquisitely beautiful and full of meaning that they just can be said and just left alone. Two of those paragraphs are the last two paragraphs in Thomas Merton's New Seeds of Contemplation. You know that. They're spectacular. Oh, by the way, that's another thing you can add to your daily spiritual practice. They're beautiful words. And then the other set of beautiful words comes from Paul Tillich. And it's where I got the phrase, the courage to be, and it speaks for itself. I first read these words in 1955. By the way, I was thinking today of telling you that when I was in clinical training in the medical center at the Institute of Religion, you could walk out of what was then the back of St. Luke's Hospital and walk across a parking lot to what was then the front door of MD Anderson. There was a parking lot, and you didn't pay to park there. You did have to be careful, though, because there were dinosaurs that... This is part of a book of sermons that Tillich wrote. It's called the book is called The Shaking of the Foundations. Isaiah, where that image comes from. I can't think of a sermon that had the impact on the country or the world of theology at the time than this sermon that Paul Tillich preached. By the way, when Paul Tillich preached at Riverside, New York Times sent a reporter to the church to cover his sermon to write about on the front page of the paper the next day. I don't think they do that anymore. Hear the words. You are accepted. You are accepted. Accepted by that which is greater than you, the name of which you do not know. Do not ask for the name now. Perhaps you will find it later. Do not try to do anything now. Perhaps later you will do much. Do not seek for anything. Do not perform anything. Do not intend anything. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted. If that happens to us, we experience grace. After such an experience, we may not be better than before, we may not believe more than before, but everything is transformed. In that moment, grace conquers sin, and reconciliation bridges the gulf of estrangement, and nothing is demanded of this experience, no religious or moral or intellectual, nothing but acceptance. I have spent at least 50 years trying to find out the answer to the meaning that was in that paragraph that I read by Carl Jung that took me here. I wanted to know, what did Carl Jung mean to Robert Smith, that hopeless alcoholic who is known as Dr. Bob, co-founder of AA, when Jung said to him, "Your situation is hopeless." And Dr. Bob said, "Well, what am I to do?" And Jung said, "Well, you might try religion." So Dr. Bob came back, and with Bill Wilson, they founded AA, and they wrote as one of their starting things, the importance of having a valid religious experience. What did that mean? As a way out of the darkness of addiction into the light of something else. What did that mean? And I think the answer is found in those words of Tillich. Every recovering alcoholic I have ever met has said that their giving up alcohol was not something they did. It was a gift of grace. To truly be involved in the process of becoming sinners of freedom and love is a gift. I just pray we are open to receive it. No matter where you go this week, no matter what happens, remember this: you carry precious cargo, so watch your step, and I will see you here next Sunday. Thank you.